This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens.
Hi, Hayden Field here, Associate Editor at Entrepreneur, and our guest today is Fallon Fatemi, who at age 19 was Google's youngest ever hire. She's also the daughter of two Persian entrepreneurs who immigrated to the U.S. during the Iranian Revolution. Clearly, she's got entrepreneurial genes, and she used them to launch her own AI company, Node. Backed by Mark Cuban, Node aims to use deep learning to analyze relationships between people and companies, then pinpoint sales, marketing, and recruiting opportunities for those companies who are also its clients. We'll chat with Fallon about what's in store for AI, data privacy, and how to pitch a prominent investor. But first, a word from our sponsors. We've heard it time and time again, as fundraising advice, as a pitch tip, and even as the first step to planning your business's revenue model. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But many growing businesses have a hodgepodge of systems for accounting, sales, inventory, and more that can keep them from getting close to their numbers. That inefficiency can drain time and resources, which can then hurt their bottom lines. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unnecessary headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly, right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide titled 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits at netsuite.com/HSH. That's netsuite.com/HSH to download your free guide. And now for our next sponsor. When you think of the sneaker brand K-Swiss, you probably get nostalgic and think of the preppy white leather K-Swiss classics that were a staple of the 90s. But K-Swiss is making a comeback and has some new and progressive products up their sleeves. The latest sneaker release is the K-Swiss Startup, purpose-built for today's entrepreneur. K-Swiss believes that entrepreneurs are the new heroes of culture. Once, all young people wanted to be an athlete in the big leagues or a celebrity in a band, but now aspirations have changed. The aspiration of today is to build your own business or brand, to be independent, creative, and successful. The new startup from K-Swiss isn't a sneaker for athletes, it's a sneaker for CEOs. With a sophisticated and sleek design and premium leather, the startup matches the versatility needed by today's hustlers going from the office to a client meeting to the airport or to a social event. It has lightweight comfort for people on their feet all day and some slick features like a zipper to make the on and off process quick and easy, great for getting through TSA. Today's entrepreneur needs to be comfortable but also stylish and presentable. These are the sneakers for you. And the K-Swiss startup is only available at kswiss.com. Cutting out the middleman and creating a killer price at just $69 for a shoe that would normally retail for over $90. The startup comes in 3 colors, each named after one of the key attributes of today's entrepreneur: risk, ambition, and vision. Go check them out today at www.kswiss.com/startup and use code ENT10 to get 10% off your purchase. If you're an aspiring entrepreneur, then take the next step. Try the new startup from K-Swiss. Fallon, at age 19, you were Google's youngest ever hire. How did you land the job?
So, funny story on that. This was in summer of 2005. And at the time, the standard career path wasn't going into startups. It was actually going into investment banking. And that was the career path that I was on. So I was actually interviewing with various investment banks to go into the financial sector. And I happened to take a summer course in entrepreneurship, which was taught by a serial entrepreneur, Mary Furlong. And through that course, got exposure to the ins and outs of entrepreneurship and angel and pitching to angels to get angel funding. And she actually recruited me to do a research project for Microsoft. And through that research project that I did, which was outside of the class, I got recommended to someone senior at Google. And that was during the time that actually, I think it was like the day before I just gotten a job offer at one of the investment banks. And so I went in to meet with Google And it was not like anything I had experienced interviewing in the financial sector. It was a very different company, and I hadn't even really heard of it at that time. So Google IPO'd, but was still sort of relatively unknown. And they basically, you know, I met with a number of people in the sales strategy and finance organization, and they kind of asked me, you know, what did I want to do? And I said, I wanted to learn everything. And that was that. I got the job.
That's amazing. And you already had a job offer from what you might have considered back then a safer option. So how did you take that, since it was a relatively unknown company at the time, how did you evaluate that opportunity? Because I think this can be applied in a lot of different scenarios. You see an opportunity that seems great, but you haven't really heard of it. It could be the next big thing, or it could not be. Like, how do you go into that and say, okay, this feels right for me, or it might be more talk than action?
So I think as I've grown in my career, I really appreciate this notion of serendipity and sort of the power of my network. And I think like earlier on, I had a plan. I had a plan from seventh grade. I was going to investment banking. I was interested in patent law. Like, so I was operating on my safe plan and had just gotten a job offer. And then coming across a revolutionary company like Google that frankly felt like a resort more than it did a corporate environment. It was just an opportunity I could not pass up. Not only, I mean, like just the caliber of people that I was meeting, that the backgrounds that they had, like they've done incredible things. Like I was meeting Olympic athletes that were working at Google to someone who put on the World Fair. And I think it was just such a unique opportunity that I could not pass it up. And it just, there's something around that intuition too, where it just kind of like felt right. It felt like I was about to embark on this incredible adventure where I actually had the opportunity to get exposure to so much more than I even thought was possible. And that was really sort of the first time that I realized that, frankly, having a plan is great and it might feel good, but the best plans are the ones you don't even know to create. They just kind of happen.
That is great advice. And I love what you said about the people too, because I think in any opportunity you're trying to evaluate, it's really about the people that are going to be involved, because that is what's going to make or break any operation.
Oh, absolutely. And you could tell also by the environment, like the cultural environment too. Like you walk into Google and I just remember it being sunny and people were throwing like a football in the office and MC Hammer was playing and there was a band and it's like all this cool stuff. But then like this company has extremely smart people working for it and they're hiring 100 people a week and everyone's talking about this incredible vision of like the future of what Google could create. At the time, it was like a little bit more competitive to Microsoft. So it's like all about the obsolescence of the operating system. And that is a completely different experience that felt so revolutionary and so cutting edge compared to like a stodgy investment bank where they're like, you know, we got to drug test you because you're in college, right?
Right. Oh my gosh. So. I can't even imagine. And then I know you're the daughter of two Persian entrepreneurs who emigrated to the US during the Iranian Revolution, switching gears a little bit. But growing up, how did their experience building a life for themselves here inspire you to follow through on your own passions with Node? So what did they teach you about entrepreneurship?
So, I mean, my parents, they came to this country with nothing and really built an incredible life for my brother and I. And the way that they did that is through, frankly, pursuing higher education and a lot of hard work. And they, despite the incredible life that they built for us and perhaps some of the wealth that we experienced growing up and going to private schools and having those opportunities that we were blessed with, they never let us forget the hard-earned value of a dollar. So every summer, for example, so a lot of that discipline and a lot of that grit was something that I think not only did I genetically get from them, it's something that they, from a discipline perspective and from like an overall framework perspective, every summer, that was not like going to summer camps and having sleepovers. It was studying a year ahead in math and science before we could have the opportunity to do those things. And then if I wanted an allowance, there was no such thing. I had to go get a job to then be able to pay for the gas to then drive the car that they had at the time, which was a gas-guzzling Suburban to get to school. So I worked three jobs. And by the way, I couldn't just get any job. I had to get a job that furthered my career in some way. So I worked at a law firm because I was interested in law and patent law. So I did research for patent lawyers, or I was tutoring kids because I was really interested in like perhaps teaching a class one day because my dad also is a part-time professor. So I think like that, while I didn't fully appreciate it in those moments when sometimes I just wanted to be a kid, I think at the same time, that discipline and that framework, I so benefited from that because I kind of took that and it felt sort of normal. And that's frankly how I operate every day, right? Being an entrepreneur, you are constantly, constantly learning. And you have to put in that hard work to become an expert in things you've never done before. And before you even have a shot at innovating that next wave.
That's a great point. And that brings me to Node, actually. Tell us a little bit about your vision for the company. I know your eventual vision for it is that it's going to become our go-to engine for personal and professional recommendations. So anything from finding your next ideal customer to like the next ideal restaurant you might be going to for dinner that night. So tell us a little bit about how the tech works right now. I know it utilizes deep learning to do this. How is the algorithm trained? How did you build it coming from experience that wasn't totally overlapping with AI? Who did you bring on your team to help really push this forward and make it happen when you didn't have as much experience in the field?
Oh, absolutely. So I guess it's important to sort of start this, to sort of answer to your several questions with maybe the story behind why I even started a company. So I spent 6 years at Google, but the 6 years I was in the startup world is really where the inspiration for Node came from. So while in the startup world, I was doing strategy consulting for startups and VCs. I was doing, you know, matchmaking and making introductions between a lot of people and companies and resources. And it was during that time I decided to actually do an analysis of all the introductions I made over the last 6 years in the startup world with people and companies that I worked with. And what I uncovered was that a lot of those introductions had actually resulted in some sort of like life-changing outcome for those individuals and businesses. So for example, I found out those introductions had led to millions in investment, a number of acquisitions, sales and marketing partnerships, hires, marriages, even a merger. And I didn't get anything for doing any of this. So for me, that was like the real aha moment where I realized, wow, like what if I could productize and therefore scale the intuition that I have behind uncovering these connections that should be made between these people and companies and having those results and all these transformative outcomes. And that's really sort of where the vision for our company Node was born, which is to connect people with opportunity at massive scale. And sort of along the way, you know, I would argue this is the entrepreneurship podcast. You know, I think half the battle of any, you know, moonshot vision is to survive long enough to find the one in a million people that can make that vision a reality. I mean, I happened to come across two one in a million AI leaders, including the godfather of search, Lee Monnier, who created the original search engine Alta Vista, also worked at Google with me, as well as our chief product officer, Michael Ranovanovich, who is the former CTO of Taleo, which is like the equivalent of, you know, sort of Salesforce for recruiting, as well as the former CTO of OpenX. So these guys have spent, you know, over three decades focused on connecting people with opportunity at massive scale. And together, we've invented what we're aptly calling artificial intuition. And we believe that in the future, every person will have an intelligent agent, like what we're calling an artificial intuition engine, whose job is to uncover all the different opportunities out there, people, companies, products, places that are relevant to you before you even know to search for it and to surface it to you in a way that results in those transformative outcomes. So in terms of the sort of go-to-market for the technology that we've invented, we've spent a number of years really honing that technology through working with early adopter customers on the market in the customer acquisition space, companies like Mitel, ShoreTel, even the Dallas Mavericks. And we've learned a lot. We've connected buyers. Our predictions and recommendations have resulted in several hundreds of millions in revenue for those companies. And we're now at the point where we've packaged up the core technology, the core building blocks of our, you know, what you mentioned, the deep learning engine itself. And we're now enabling third-party applications to power feature sets that connect people within their applications in the right context to those outcomes that they care about. And so essentially we've turned the solution into a true platform, which has been kind of our longer term vision as a company, to be able to sort of accelerate those connections within all the applications that you're using every day. So whether you're using a CRM, which today is not sort of AI enabled, with Node, that CRM can now release a personalized set of features that can automatically identify new markets of opportunity for its clients, or help Johnny's sales rep find more prospects like the prospects that he's best at converting for that organization. So it's almost adding this layer of intuition into these systems that helps continue to drive the outcomes that matter within the context of those applications and the workflow that's being conducted in those applications. Same with an ATS system. It could also power talent discovery, right? How do you find the right person for this role? Well, that person might already be in your organization. So you can leverage nodes. These applications can leverage nodes to build out feature sets that really deliver on the vision that they have. And this is sort of playing on this sort of bigger trend of in the last 20 years, like over 50% of the Fortune 500 companies have disappeared. And we're talking about a life expectancy from 1955 of 75 years to 2015 of 15 years. And that doesn't even have factor AI in it. So in the next couple of years, just like imagine if that's where we're at in 2015, imagine where we're going to be in 2025. AI is going to play a huge part in essentially disrupting the companies that we know today. And the other aspect is while AI is accelerating the pace of innovation, it's totally also accelerating the decline of the companies that can't innovate quickly. And so we're really here to help take a lot of these companies that could be leveraging this cutting edge technology that frankly don't have the kind of core DNA or don't have millions and years and lots of time to try and engage in this talent war where there's 500 people on the planet that know to leverage deep learning to have to build a system like Node themselves. Instead, they can just plug and play and leverage Node to become basically a market leader.
Absolutely. That's actually a great point. I wanted to ask, so you can use Node right now in accordance with any software system. Basically, you can adapt it to use if you're a marketer using a CRM, if you're using some other software system for your business, there's a way to plug it in.
Yeah. So really the way to think about kind of the core use cases that Node's artificial intuition engine can be highly valuable for is kind of the way that marketers might think about it. You might think about it as a journalist, right? It's like, for example, you know who your best customers are. You know who perhaps some of the best founders are that you've interviewed in the past. You know who some of your best employees are. And that's a really complex problem to try to use the old way of AI to solve to find more of them, right? Like, how do you define best? How do you articulate best in a set of codified rules using the sort of old way of AI, which uses and sort of approach it from a deterministic perspective? You can't. And even if you tried to, you're limiting the possibilities of perhaps finding those next markets or pockets of talent or the next breakout stories of opportunity. So the power of the engine that we've invented is that all you have to do is provide an example of essentially a training set of people or companies that represent the outcome you're looking to build a feature upon or deliver an outcome upon. So you want to find more customers like your best customers, you just provide a set of examples of people and companies that represent the definition of best that you're looking to optimize. It could be perhaps highest deal size customers. The system takes it from there. It figures out what does that mean, both implicit and explicit, and it delivers predictions that are upwards of 81% more accurate than these sort of traditional deterministic methods that take many years and time to implement and develop.
That makes sense. And so I also wanted to ask, that brings me to a good question about the algorithm in general. So obviously the training data, the data it's using to make these other predictions is really important. So do you guys have a guidelines for the amount of data you need to submit in order for the algorithm to generate these other recommendations based on the ones that you're giving it? I know recently, you know, Facebook came under fire for not allowing certain opportunities to be marketed to certain groups based on income, race, a couple of other things. So how do you regulate that if someone says, okay, well, I want to make sure I am targeting customers like my best paying customers, but it ends up leaving out certain groups? How would you reconcile that?
So, I mean, from the Facebook perspective, it sounds like they're using some, like they've created a set of rules and therefore filters on top of whatever algorithms they're using that are actually preventing the kind of full-fledged access to all those possibilities. Our solution doesn't sort of work in that way. And the way to kind of think about it is, so first of all, we're dealing with facts. So understanding your work history, understanding that you are a customer of this organization, that you, all of this information is like publicly available. It's data that's factually true about you. Now, it really depends on the feature set that's being built on top of Node, basically how the solution is being used. So in the example of I want to find more employees like my best employees, well, I could provide a set of examples of some of my best employees. Some of those are male, some of those are female, some of them have variety of skill sets. I don't exactly know what makes them the best beyond this sort of intuitive sense and maybe some parameters that explicit variables that I know I was hiring for, like perhaps domain expertise that they have. But what the system is going to do is pick up on both the implicit and explicit signals that exist there. And some of which might actually be really important, but hard for me to codify. And it's going to find more like that. At that point, it's up to sort of the end packaging of whatever feature set is building on top of it. That's sort of at the developer or product development level. There's sort of a set of business decisions or product decisions that can be made in terms of if they want to provide, I don't know, do what Facebook did and sort of filter that down. Or maybe they only, if they have a male workforce, a set of male engineers, and they want to find more like that, but they want it to be a more diverse workforce, they could say, okay, I'm going to build a model based on the engineers that work in my organization that I'm defining are excellent. And I'm going to specifically have Node filter out the men and find women that look like that. The system can do that.
Okay, that's great to know because, yeah, I've been seeing some AI recruiting tools lately have, in interviews I've heard, that it can be tricky to train these algorithms because the data you're using, I mean, historically, more men are hired than women, especially in certain fields. A lot of white people are prioritized over some minorities. So it can be hard because if you're defining, you know, okay, these employees of mine are excellent, they're more likely to be in those types of groups. So that's great that you can kind of tell the algorithm, okay, like I want them to be like this, but filter out this type. Is there a human hand in this at all? Like, can you, are there consultants where you can, where that will tell you about the potential risks of you inputting certain data and make sure that you know about options like that if you're a consultant or someone else using the software?
Yeah, totally. I mean, our platform enables an unlimited set of features or solutions to be built on top of it. So depending on what the desired outcome is, you could absolutely bring in like a consultant that's an expert in diversity to help inform how you should be filtering on top of the model or be thinking about the diversity in your organization and how to kind of provide a framework around that. A lot of stuff on, you know, we do a lot of thinking around this, obviously, with our chief product officer having come from the HR space where at Taleo, they were transacting, you know, 15% of the hires in the U.S. before their acquisition to Oracle. And there's also a lot of work that can be done at the actual like deep learning sort of predictive model perspective. So like, for example, there's certain signals the system can pick up on that you might not explicitly know about a person, but like we as humans can sort of read someone's name in an article and infer based on, for example, infer someone's gender or ethnicity, right? Even though we've never met that person based on our knowledge of the world. The technology that we've invented can do that as well, but because there's certain attributes like your name that might give those signals of your gender and ethnicity, those are things we can actually anonymize or hide from a predictive model. And it can actually deliver on a desired result of providing more diverse recommendations or diverse outcomes. So there's a lot of thinking that we do on that front as well, just from a technology perspective, because we operate at that use case level and we provide models that are at that use case level so that anyone can kind of plug and play and get value from Node right away to deliver on that business outcome they care about. So there's definitely a lot more work that can be done in that field, and we'll definitely be sharing some of that out soon.
Let's say you're signing up for this and you're going to use it for, say, recruiting, which I know it's only one of the many uses for it. Is the onus on the client to hire a consultant and kind of think about the ways that this could go awry if they input you data on their part? Or does the company Node in general kind of walk them through, okay, this is a human, maybe a consultant or a customer relationship manager, say, okay, here's what you need to think about while you're doing this. We'll keep an eye on it to make sure nothing, no huge red flags come up.
Yeah, I mean, we this is really a part of the kind of value consulting that we provide. It's definitely like not sort of core to, I'd say, our sort of offering, but it's something that we think is really important as a, you know, acting as a strategic partner to our customers. So we'll connect them to other experts. We'll advise them on what we've seen as best practices in the market. We'll help them as they kind of think through the building of the different kind of tools or features that they want on top of Node. And we'll guide them in getting the results that they desire. So, I mean, we really kind of do engage in that learning process, but I'd say it's not like kind of the, it's not something that we necessarily have to do. We choose to do it.
Right. Yeah. Cause I definitely think that's, when people are coming into this for the first time, they often don't even know all the things that could be changed by using such a tool. So that's great. The education is so important. When it comes to helping small business owners or people with smaller companies that might be using Node for personalized recommendations. Something like Google's TensorFlow is obviously out there, and they could use something like that. What does Node offer that goes so much beyond that?
Sure. So there's lots of building blocks out there. And there's this kind of new set of tools that have come out. I think Google just released Cloud ML. Microsoft released a similar product as well. It's kind of in this field of, it's called AutoML or Automated Machine Learning. Mm-hmm. And the way to think about these tools is that they're Lego blocks. Okay. So they are targeted at a lower level of the actual technology stack and for the sort of data analyst or data scientist as the end user. That means that the organization that's testing out some of these products, they still have to build the data architecture, acquire the data, clean the data. These things are not only technically challenging, they take years to do. I mean, they require a lot of people to do it. And it's actually very challenging to also do it very well, to set all of that up so that they can then have a data set or therefore a training set that's pre-labeled that then can be passed through one of these systems, which helps make just one kind of aspect of the entire sort of process a little bit more efficient, which is like not having to tweak what we call hyperparameters. Now, they still have to not only build the data architecture, own the sort of data piece of it, manage the data piece of it, clean the data piece of it. They have to build the training set around it. They also have to focus on building the logic at the use case level for these models that then eventually might lead to some sort of feature set that then ends up being rolled out either client-facing or used internally. So what we do is we remove the need for all of that. And I didn't even mention the infrastructure. Making something like this scale is extremely challenging. We allow an organization to stay at the application level, which means any engineer in their organization can leverage Node and build a cutting-edge deep learning feature in minutes versus or days versus years. And the models and the data is already prepackaged within Node. So all they're literally doing is passing through a training set, which has sparse information that basically includes identifiers for people and companies. And Node takes it from there to enrich that information, to intuit on top of it, to then build and identify which model to select, train that model, and then deliver the results of that model in real time via a REST API. Which then plugs into whatever front-end feature that organization is leveraging. So what does that mean for that organization? They're leveraging their existing resources, so much more efficient. From a time-to-value perspective, they're able to deploy a market-winning feature in days versus years. They're able to focus on their core competency, which is to imagineer those next set of feature sets that they've been dreaming about but unable to execute until now with Node. And be able to rapidly then invent, innovate, and actually publish the feature sets to their clients. And that's really the sort of power of our system, in addition to sort of providing the better actual predictions and results.
That is great. Last question about this, and then we'll move on to basically your vision for Node and what it was like pitching to some high-profile investors. But I wanted to clarify. So, for example, at Entrepreneur, we use an SEO software that when you put it, your story into the software, it will come up with a few little red flags. It'll be like, oh, make sure you use the keyword a few more times, or there's not enough information here, add more text. We don't use it for every article, but it's a practice that we use sometimes if we want to make sure something is optimized for SEO. So if someone is, I know you want to eventually move this from more enterprise clients to be able to be used by anyone, small business owner, consumer, individual. When it comes to putting data into this tool, are there any type for someone that's newer to the implications of this and what it could really mean and how it could skew their results? Are there any types of things like that that come up as you input your data? Like, okay, this data set looks pretty small. Alert, it might not be the result you're looking for. Oh, this data set skews a lot more towards men, you might want to adjust for that in your results. Things like that that really lay out what could go wrong.
So the system will provide feedback when you do sort of pass through a training set, and which it uses as a query. It will actually give you feedback and tell you, okay, this model that has been built based on this training set doesn't have a high sort of sense of confidence in its ability to predict. Therefore, you need to provide more information. So we provide that level of visibility programmatically, which then allows organizations to sort of build rules and then features on top of it to say, okay, provide more data or less data. We also enable the ability to get visibility into sort of the explicit attributes beneath a list. So whether that list is your training set or whether that list is the list of set of entities is something you want to predict against, you can use an API that we offer, an insights and distribution API, to be able to understand what are the unique attributes of the people and companies within that set, to then be able to surface some of the perhaps biases or things that you haven't considered right there in front of you. So we do offer options to be able to surface those things.
Okay, great. And then take us through your ideal vision for Node in about 5 years. So I know you want to roll it out, like we talked about, on a consumer level, you know, for you to be able to use it for any type of recommendation. So let's say you wake up, what happens? Like, as an individual consumer, ideally, what would you want them to use Node for throughout their day?
Oh, wow. I mean, I have a whole opinion on what the day in the future should look like. in 5 years, I think we'll get there. We might all be in VR or AR by then. So from my perspective, Node is essentially pervasive everywhere. So it is your personalized agent, your intelligent agent, almost like a her-like experience, who's only surfacing to you suggestions and insights for things that you've either asked it to find or that you didn't know to ask to find, but are absolutely relevant to you. So whether that's recommending that today, you wake up in the morning and here are the articles that you should be reading, Fallon, because these are things that are related to stuff that you like or that you didn't even know that you'd be interested in, or something of significance to your industry or whatever, right? To, hey, you should actually meet this person today that you don't know yet, and here is why, and have the system actually help broker that connection. Alternatively, it could also be suggesting things like, here is a book that you should read that might be transformative to your life or help you with something that you're doing right now. So I see this thing being both passive as well as active, but when it's actually engaging with you, it's engaging with you on something that brings value to your life in a way that's highly meaningful, personal or professional. And I think that's the future of social media. I don't think it's these feeds that we all hate that we're addicted to. I think it's all, we are entering into a world of personalized discovery, and the technology that's going to enable that is not the old way of AI with thousands of data scientists, is deep learning technology that can identify these signals that are important that we don't even know to search for and put those in front of you before you know to ask, and have that entire experience be personalized to each one of us. And that is the world we're entering into, and we aim to be that layer, that discovery layer that's powering that.
I can't even imagine the scale you guys would grow to, because I know you've mentioned you want it to be the Google of AI. Another question. So lately, obviously, social media companies have been under fire a lot, and it's usually because they're creating a sort of echo chamber in terms of furthering extremist views, showing content that relates to content you've been consuming that might take you further down a path that, in the best case scenario, can make you a more empathetic person, in the worst case scenario, might foster hate or closed-mindedness. The possibilities are endless. Twitter's been getting a lot of this. YouTube also, with its algorithm of recommending videos. So there's obviously a lot of responsibility when it comes to personalized recommendations, because, of course, you can't be responsible for what someone consumes or what they like. But it is hard when you're recommending things based on what they like. Where do you draw the line? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this gets back to this TED talk that was about filter bubbles. How do you get out of filter bubbles, right? There's what I like. There's what I like based on what I already like. And there's what I might love that's out there that I don't even know that I should search. And I think we've seen some really great examples of what I mean when I talk about we're entering this world of personalized discovery. You think about it in the music space, right? Like, remember when we all used to use iTunes? Right? It's a very search-focused experience. You have to know the artists you like, the first music to listen to it. Now with platforms like Pandora and Spotify, they're taking the input of artists that I and songs that I like and helping me uncover independent artists or new genres that I never knew that I would love and I would have never searched for before, and putting those right in front of me and continuing to facilitate that discovery that does break me out of this sort of traditional filter bubble, which is very much focused on like social circles or like just your behavior data or cohorts of behavior data, which is even worse, not even really personalized to you. And I think, like, especially with the power of AI technology comes great responsibility. And I think we are very much entering into this time where deep learning, like, we're seeing examples, while it's still in research mode for a lot of organizations, we're seeing examples of this technology being able to actually, like, have exhibit fashion sense and become a fashion designer or create content. Like, I think in the future, it's going to be a little bit challenging. We talk about all this fake news and stuff. I mean, if the AI is going to actually learn from the type of content that's out there, it's going to start to create content, it might end up polluting our feeds with content that's not even, let alone like outside of our filter bubble, it's not even true. So, I mean, I think we have to really have some serious discussions and be thoughtful about what is, with this technology, we're going to have great powers here. But there's also a lot of pretty challenging trade-offs that we have to work through. And I think a solution to that is discovery platforms like Node. And I think like the definition of discovery isn't like help me find what I'm looking for. The definition of discovery is uncover the things I don't even know I should search for that perhaps I have never seen before, but that might open up an entirely new world of possibilities to me. And I think it goes into like, I think as these bigger organizations are grappling with these issues, they're going to need to define what discovery means to them in a way that is much more thoughtful than what we're experiencing right now. So I think I'll be really interested in seeing, like I saw a tweet the other day that every show in the future will end up being like The Simpsons, except all the actors will quit and the AI is just going to create like the next episode. That's actually very feasible. Isn't that crazy?
I can definitely see that. For Node specifically, are you guys planning on creating a set of best practices or rules that will kind of govern what you won't recommend, what you will recommend when someone starts to go down a dubious path, kind of like Facebook has had to in terms of trending content and seeing what they're going to promote and what they're not going to promote, what they're going to remove from the platform and what they won't?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with each one of the strategic partners that we work with, we are preaching to them the sort of future that we're seeing, not only in terms of the greater market shifts and technology shifts I described, but also in terms of the actual shift in their space. And I think in general, you know, when you're the founder of an AI company, you have to really think about like the ethics from the beginning. And we spent a lot of time on that because you have to engineer that into the infrastructure. You have to think about that in terms of, you know, how you even set up the system and where the feedback loops lie and what is the go-to-market that, you know, what are the types of partners you're even willing to work with and what are the types of feature sets you're okay with powering? We do a lot. We've done a lot of that work early on as well as now. And so, I mean, from our perspective, we're definitely, you know, that is a part of our sort of value consulting with our clients. We're preaching that too. But I think generally speaking, you know, when we're focused on B2B, right, a lot of the value that end users care about are the vision of these companies, right? I want to, CRM is trying to help organizations use their tool to close more revenue faster. ATS system is trying to help people hire people that are right for roles and retain them. And so to date, we haven't seen too many like scary situations, right? But I think as we start to move into other use cases, it's definitely going to be, you know, top of mind.
Got it. And then consumer data. So you'll be collecting a lot of it. You'll know what people like, what they don't like, what they're more likely to buy, what they're not more likely to buy. What are the protections in place for user data in this way? Do you have guidelines for who you'll sell it to, who you won't? How will consumers know where their data is going? Yeah, just take us through that policy really quick.
Sure. So our clients will use Node to build features on top of it. So if it's a consumer application that's using Node, say, to build a model for targeting trips to Aruba and finding people that are likely to be interested in a trip to Aruba, and it's a travel company that's using it, well, they're going to be leveraging Node's AI on top of the consumer data that you've opted in to let them have. And Node
will drive recommendations. Okay, so it'll be opt-in.
Yeah, it'll be opt-in, and we're going to create a better experience for you within the context of that application or that experience. So it's only going to, if anything, it'll actually make like the reason why you provide them data actually useful.
Got it. Okay, no, that's great to hear that it's opt-in. And then moving gears to when you're fundraising. So what was it? Obviously one of your high-profile investors is Mark Cuban, and I hear that you met him at South by Southwest, had a typical conversation with him about untapped opportunities in tech, but you didn't know who he was. So we talk about networking a lot on this podcast. I personally used to hate that word. My mom used to always say network, 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 and I was like, oh my gosh, that just sounds so fake. Then a source eventually told me, don't think about it like networking. Think about it like, who in the room would I actually want to be friends with in real life? Because that's who's going to help you anyway. So that kind of changed my view on it. But when it comes to that conversation with Mark, do you think that not knowing who he was at the time helped you network more genuinely? And knowing what you know now, what's your advice for listeners who might be trying to promote their own company and are about to enter into a ton of different networking situations.
Oh, yeah. So I, too, don't like the term networking because I think the connotation there is that if you're doing it for no real purpose other than to meet a lot of people at a very sort of shallow level and then eventually ask them for things that they don't even know you well enough to want to help you with. And I agree with what your source suggested to you, which is to kind of reframe that, right? Like, I think going to an event, it's great to meet people. But I think what I've found most valuable is I like to have deep connections with people. So if I meet someone in an event, I might go to an event with 1,000 people and I might come away with having had 3, 4, 5 deep conversations with people I didn't know before that were much beyond surface level, where I got to understand, like, what are the challenges they're having? Like, who are some people they should meet that I know? And that kind of natural exchange of just getting to know someone more deeply and where they're from and what they like to do. And then understanding a little bit more about their business. That's now someone that I could go have like many more drinks with. And that's a much deeper connection than, you know, meeting 100 people in a room. And maybe you forget most of their names, but you're connected with them on LinkedIn. So, I mean, I think it's really important where I met with Mark. Like, yeah, I didn't know who he was. I just thought I was having a conversation with a really smart guy. And it was through that connection that we kept in touch. I helped him out with diligence in some companies that he was thinking about investing in on the West Coast. I introduced him to some startups that he should invest in. I introduced him to Drew Housing and made him an advisor to Dropbox, let him invest in the pre-IPO round. So it's like we built a genuine friendship over time that ultimately resulted in value for him. But later on, when I started my company, he wrote one of my first checks and was one of my first supporters. And so I think like you have to really think through relationships in a truly genuine way. And that it's not about what can you do for me today? It's about how can you build a genuine connection with someone that who knows where that person's going to be, right? Everyone's talented. That might result longer term in not only you providing value to them from making an introduction that might change their life, as I have, to them maybe making an introduction for you that completely transforms yours. So I think like that's a really important piece. And as people are fundraising, I think it's really important to have a set of mentors and advisors and other peers like CEOs that have done this before and are at later stages than you to kind of guide you through that process. Fundraising is like sales. You can waste your time and not get anywhere. And that's the worst place that you can be. So you have to be really clear about who are you really looking to work with from a personal and professional perspective when you think about investors. What are the value points that you need from them? And then also, like, what do they, like, get advice from people that know you as to whether you might actually get along with them, that also know a lot of investors, to, like, be able to help you kind of better vet your thinking around it and then also kind of calibrate the type of people that you'll eventually want to meet. And I'm also a big fan of like directly reaching out to people or getting introductions. So it's like, you want to meet an investor, get an introduction to them, but really be clear on why you want to meet with them and where you think that value is, and also interview them, because it's just as much them evaluating you as an investment as you're evaluating them as an investor. I think that's really important.
Got it. That's great advice. And then last question for you. What was it like actually pitching the company to Mark? I know now you're probably pretty close when you ended up actually pitching the company. It was years into your relationship, but can you outline your best pitching strategy for people listening who might be making a high stakes pitch soon?
Know your audience. That's the biggest piece of advice I can give. Know your audience. Come in well-educated, understand, there's an art and a science, too, for sure. Understand how they think, understand what they've invested in and what their motivations might be. Ask questions up front to really vet and understand their interests or exposures to the space that you're operating in. And do that discovery like you would any sales process. And then when you pitch someone, I mean, like pitching Mark Cuban, it doesn't matter how long I've known him, he's an intimidating guy. He's accomplished a lot. He's someone I view as like a mentor. And I always want to impress him, right? And at the same time, you have to realize that, you have to really just lean into the passion that you feel for the problem space that you're in, the reason why you believe you're the right person to solve this problem. You got to communicate that in a way that the audience is going to understand and it's going to resonate. And that you're also telling a story to, based on knowing your audience, in this case, Mark Cuban being a billionaire, as to how you're going to build a company that's going to result in significant ROI from that perspective, right? If I'm talking about a small market opportunity, he's not going to be interested. If I'm talking about building the next we're picking up where search leaves off, and we're building what comes next after Google. And we have a multi-billion dollar market opportunity. I'm going to illustrate that to him and really get him to lean in on that. So again, I think it comes back to really knowing your audience.
Awesome. Thanks so much. That's great advice. And really appreciate you making the time to talk. Thanks again, Fallon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
That's our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, and leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of this show and our other great podcasts. That's entrepreneur.com. Thanks.